welcome to Rabble Radio. It's Friday, January 12th, 2024. I'm your host, Brianne Doyle. Thanks so much for tuning in. Rabble's got its finger on the beat of the issues that matter to you. If you're curious about the latest news in Canadian politics, labor, environment, or social justice, you've come to the right place. This is news for the rest of us, free of corporate influence. This week on Rabble Radio, we're re-releasing an episode from 2020 in which former Rabble Radio host Victoria Fenner sat down with Jean Leggett, a game developer from Oakville, Ontario, to talk about why diversity and ethical storytelling needs to be encouraged in the gaming world. Jean Leggett is the CEO of One More Story Games. A note for listeners, in 2019, Leggett was a recipient of a scholarship from the International Game Developers Association Next Gen Leaders Program. The goal of the scholarship is to bring diversity into the gaming world by supporting participants with personal and professional development opportunities. This is the scholarship she's referring to in the interview. Here are Victoria Fenner and Jean Leggett in conversation. Take a listen.
I have been very honored and privileged to be selected as one of the 10 recipients of what's called the Next Generation Leadership Scholarship. It's from the International Game Developers Association's Foundation, which is a nonprofit part of the International Game Developers Association. And their whole mission and mandate is to promote the voices of diversity, which is gender, race, socioeconomic background, sexual orientation, country, age, life experience, etc. They're really trying to amplify who gets some spotlight, who gets some attention, and with the hope and the goal of promoting more diversity in game development.
Well, we'll talk about the diversity or lack of diversity in games in a few minutes, but can you just give us a bit of background about how you have come to this award and what you're doing in game development?
Absolutely. So I'll share a little bit about what I'm doing in game development first. I have been running a video game studio, a very small one, with the goal of helping authors and storytellers take their short stories and novels and transform them into interactive stories. And our games are very much like a book meets game experience. They're pretty narrative heavy, but imagine being able to read a book, but also click around in the world and click on things and engage with characters and have conversations. So that's what we've been doing for the last couple of years. And right now I'm working on a game which is about a sexual assault survivor trying to figure out who's implicating her in a murder. So that's a little bit about that. I came to this scholarship. It's a scholarship that's been on my radar for a few years. This one in particular, the Next Generation Leaders, is focused on helping those who are in their fifth to eighth year as game developers. And I've just wrapped up my sixth year in game development, and this was the third time that I've applied. And you know, it's interesting. A lot of other people who received the scholarship last year or the year before, they also were on their second or third application. It's such a competitive process. They have, you know, anywhere from 150 to 200 applicants around the world vying for this scholarship. It's this particular, so the IGDA Foundation has multiple scholarships. One is for scholars. So if you're in your undergraduate, graduate, or postgraduate program, you can apply for that. This one is specifically to be mentored by more senior people in the industry. So it comes with 2 years of mentorship, 2 years of conference attendance at our largest games conference, which is in San Francisco. So passes to that. Travel and accommodation stipend. And so, you know, the equivalent of that scholarship is anywhere from $8,000 to $9,000 US. It's very humbling, and it's exciting because I'm so passionate about wanting to make sure that I'm amplifying the voices of authors who wouldn't normally get to be heard in video games.
Right. You also identify as a feminist. You're also, social justice issues are very important to you. So what have you seen in your your time in game development as well, but also your partner has also been involved in games, some pretty major studios too. I mean, so what have both of you seen in terms of some of the problems in the video game industry?
Oh, well, that's like a whole hour-long talk, Victoria.
Well, good. We've only got 25 minutes or so, but let's get into it.
Well, you know, I think one of the biggest things, and we're starting to see a shift, is my husband, Blair, who is my co-founder in our studio, he's been in the games industry since 2001 as an employee, but we both have played games since the 80s. You know, I think growing up, I never really paid much attention to the fact that there weren't women at the center of the games, you know, as protagonists. I remember playing Super Mario, and it was always that you had to go and rescue Peach, Princess Peach. And it never occurred to me as a kid that she needed to be rescued. So we're not really paying too much attention to the implications of that. But now that games as a medium is maturing and evolving, we're starting to apply literary criticism to video games. And that has kicked off a whole host of backlash from people who say, games aren't political. Why are you applying your social justice warrior perspective to video games? Video games are just for fun. I laugh at that and I think, wow, you must be the type of person that watches a movie and doesn't see context and nuance. You know, like, what kind of a life is it if you can't understand subtext? We've been seeing a lot of criticism and attention being put towards creating believable women characters, women that aren't archetypes and tropes. We want more depth. Part of that, I think, is coming from the fact that the number of people playing games is expanding. Half of people who play games are women. It's more depending on the type of platform that we're playing on. So here's an example of how sexism still exists. They say roughly 56% of people on mobile games are women. Mobile games creates 47% of video game revenue. There are people, and I will call them angry toxic dude bros, who say that mobile games are not real games. Now, why is that? Well, because they're under the belief that a real game is a game that you would play on a console. So your Xboxes, your PlayStations, or even on your PC. But heaven forbid that a mobile game be considered a real game. It's just another form of gatekeeping, and we're so tired of the gatekeeping, it's ridiculous. We're not listening to them, and neither are the large studios, to be honest. Like, they have thrown so much money into either acquiring or developing intellectual property from mobile games because they're not going to miss out on a money-making opportunity. When it comes down to it, people will start to develop content when they believe there's money for it. So now you're seeing a lot more content being geared towards women gamers. So we're seeing a switch and a movement towards narrative games because we have more women playing. Women are more inclined to play narrative and puzzle games. So that's a piece of it. Yeah, it's interesting. And then I think the other bigger piece of it, when it fits into the feminism, is because we have more and more simplified tools and software, like, for example, like the one that we've developed, we're starting to see more biographical content come out.
Such as? What do you mean by biographical content?
There is a game called That Dragon Cancer, which is about a family's experience of the diagnosis and medical treatment and the passing of their four-year-old that I believe had leukemia. And that was such a well-received game for its emotional impact. And at the same time, people were saying, I can't believe they created a game and monetized their child's death. It's like, well, we're not monetizing his death. We're sharing the story. And in the creation of art, we should be compensated for our time.
Well, you know, in the art world, though, we sometimes have this dichotomy where they say, oh, you're making money off of your art, so you're therefore not pure. I mean, is it because the game, you know, that games are so clearly identified as industry that there isn't room for either the people who aren't making huge amounts of money on it or for alternative kinds of storylines? Is it because it's all about the money, 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 give us more, give us more?
Oh, wow. Again, that's such a deep conversation. You still very much have, so we have what's called AAA. Right. So you have your Ubisofts, your Tencents, your Electronic Arts. These are the companies that are generating billions of dollars a year in our industry. Then you have the indie game scene, which can range anywhere from, oh, they only have $5 to $10 million to make a game, whereas you have indies that have $0 that are making a game. So I feel like the spectrum of indie really needs to be stretched out a lot more. Because somebody who has a $500 budget should not be considered the same indie budget as somebody who has $20 million. But what that is, I have gone and spoken to hundreds, if not thousands, of people in the last 7 years. And there are very much, and you know these people, Victoria, I am an artiste. And I believe I should make no money for my art and I should suffer. I'm like, oh, wow, it must be really nice. It must be so nice that you feel so strongly about your art that you're willing to, I don't know, what, suffer? Does that make you somehow a better person? I don't think it makes you a better person. I think that it makes you, for example, I'm not willing to compromise on the vision of the game that we're creating. We are very overdue in delivering it, but I have been intensely mindful and I teach masterclasses on creating ethical narratives for including the conversation of PTSD and sexual assault. So I am having that conversation with other game developers to say, these are nuanced things that we cannot just willy-nilly throw into a game for the sake of fetishizing this. We have an ethical duty and responsibility as game developers to approach this very carefully. And I fully plan to be a profitable game creator, right? I like having a roof over my head. I like having food in my belly. And so there's a struggle right happening right now in the culture of games, in that we have the pure artists, we have people who want to monetize but don't know how to monetize, and then we have the people that are willing to do anything for money. And I think that's where part of our culture of trying to figure out how this medium is going to evolve to the next steps.
So what have you seen in terms of other companies and people, nonprofit organizations that are doing social justice oriented gaming? Are there a lot of them out there, or is it still fairly underground?
It's not underground anymore. It's definitely coming out. So for example, in the last couple of years, there was a game called Senua's Sacrifice, which was about a woman. And if I'm not mistaken, it's a woman with schizophrenia. And it was an incredibly well-received, I think it was Hellblade Senua's Sacrifice. It was incredibly well-received. They did a lot of research into it, and you know, we have organizations that specifically are developing best practices guidebooks for developers saying, listen, if you're going to cover mental health, here's a guidebook and please consider these things. One of the things that I talk to when I'm giving this talk on ethical design choices is to make sure that people aren't appropriating the voices of others, right? If I am a white video game developer, I should not be taking the lead on creating a story about, for example, Japanese internment camps or slavery in the South. That's not my story to tell or shepherd.
And how are people, when you present this this idea, do they understand your point, or are they puzzled by it, or what?
I have had a little bit of resistance. I've had somebody say, well, I don't see why it would matter if you hired a black game developer to tell the story about slavery. I'm like, it does matter. It does matter because as a white person, it's not your story to tell. And it might not necessarily be that black person's story to tell, but it comes from the place of a cultural history of oppression that we cannot understand as people in privilege. So I also, like, I remember somebody coming up to me when I gave a talk last month, I think it was, And he said, well, I want to write this compelling female character, but I'm a guy. And I said, listen, I'm not saying don't write women characters. What I am saying is talk to your women friends, get them to read the character, consult with other women, because we've all read those horrible romance novels where a man writes a woman and a love scene. And it's just so disjointed from reality that a woman would never have written some of the ludicrous things that men have written about them. So making sure that you talk to people who have accurate information about what it is that you're writing. So that's a really big piece of it. There are conferences coming out specifically aimed at serious play. So serious play being that area of games that is focused on, I guess, I don't know how I would describe it. It's, and serious, I don't know if it really encapsulates, I don't think serious is the perfect word for it, because these games aren't necessarily serious, but they are dealing with subject matter that we don't typically see in entertainment.
Well, I was going to ask, too, is the games that you're talking about, I don't see them anywhere. I mean, I'm not a hardcore gamer myself, so it's not like I even know where to go to look for these things. But for a lot of people, it's their iPhone. The marketing strength isn't behind a lot of these organizations that are doing the socially conscious games either, are they?
You're not going to see that kind of marketing push on television or anything like that on a bigger scale from these multi-billion dollar companies, because they might be willing to develop a smaller game with a subsidiary studio that has a mental health issue or some kind of serious topic, but they're not necessarily going to make that a crown jewel. The kinds of games that you see on television during the Super Bowl are the ones that are already generating multiple millions of dollars a day in transactions from what's called the free-to-play model, right? It's free-to-play, and then you can add things in to generate more money. So the larger studios that kind of have that money to do massive marketing push, they're still shying away from the more serious games content. So you asked where you could find those things. Well, I mean, if you're interested in more deeply thoughtful narratives, then I would say find some game developers on Twitter. And there's a huge and healthy independent games scene on Twitter, which I've been part of for the last couple of years. You know, we're constantly talking about serious games, and we're, you know, for example, last year and the year before, I spoke at multiple conferences with a colleague of mine. Her name is Ella Logren, and she's based out of Melbourne. She created a game which is about her eating disorder, her disordered eating. And that went on to be played by tens of thousands of people. But how would you know about that game? You wouldn't necessarily know about that from a Facebook ad. Her games are free, so she's not monetizing them, so she's not going to advertise them. So if you want to get into the nitty-gritty of some really cool independent games, then you're going to need to seek out the weird niches of Twitter, of game dev Twitter, and come seek out people like me that are constantly trying to amplify the voices of games that we don't hear about. For example, the conference, the Game Developers Conference in San Francisco, two women from Pakistan were recipients of similar scholarships. I think one of them won the same scholarship that I won, and then the other one won the Scholars Scholarship. But because they are from Pakistan, their visas were rejected by the United States. And so these two women are not able to come to San Francisco to present, you know, to even be part of the Game Developers Conference, GDC.
Yeah, it's as you talk about the dynamics in the gaming industry, I'm thinking about there are some parallels with the film industry, some which you've already pointed out. But one of the things is we now have film festivals so we can find more obscure things. I mean, they mm-hmm. have their gatekeeping process too, but wouldn't it be great to have gaming festivals that focus on some of the lesser known stuff too, eh?
We do. But general public doesn't really know about
them.
Yeah,
that's right. Yeah.
And I think that comes in part because games is still poo-pooed as this thing that children do. And it is not. The average age of a gamer is 35. The average age of a female gamer is 43. I'm about to be average. You know, so like the way that the mainstream media portrays video games is like, oh, they're all shoot 'em ups and they're stabby, stabby, shooty, shooty. No, games is so diverse. So, for example, I've been asked to speak at two conferences during Berlin Games Week in April. And part of Berlin Games Week is they have Quo Vadis, they have Womanize, which is a one-day summit for women in games. And then they also have something called A Maze Festival. And they're looking at the more independent, weird nooks and crannies. A lot of these conferences, which I feel like there's a conference every other week in Europe, you know, all of these countries are celebrating the diversity of games. And they're looking for the quirky, the non-AAA games, because they really feel that's important to amplify the voices that aren't going to get heard.
Right. So it sounds like the toxic bro dudes then, they're still out there, but the gaming is growing past them. Is that reasonable to say?
You know what? I think that's a beautiful way of putting it. I think that while there is still some very much legitimate concerns about the toxicity that exists in games, it's because women have been harassed, they have been threatened, people have had to leave their homes. Like, video games has a very uncomfortable historical thing that happened to us a number of years ago called Gamergate. I'm not going to get into it because even just talking about it makes me a target. But it's one of the reasons why I chose an apartment building with 24-hour security. And so it's kind of ridiculous to me, by the act of making games, that it would make anybody a target for harassment and abuse. I look forward to us just ignoring and drowning out the pettiness and the squabbling of these misogynist, angry little dudes. And for us just to focus on making games that are meaningful and fun and engaging and inclusive, right? Because then we can just say, you know what? Go play your shoot 'em ups. We're going to be over here. We've created a much bigger section of games that is inclusive and welcoming for everyone.
Victoria Fenner, former Rabble Radio host, and Jean Leggett, CEO of One More Story Games, in conversation back in 2020. We have a bunch of really special interviews like this one that are available on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and Rabble.ca, which we encourage you to check out. And of course, remember to like, share, and subscribe. Now it's time for a segment we like to call In Case You Missed It. And for that, let's turn it over to Rabble editor Nick Seabrook. Over to you, Nick.
Thanks, Brianne. This week in national news, Brandy Morin, a Cree Iroquois French multimedia journalist, was arrested by the Edmonton police while covering a raid on an outdoor encampment of unhoused people. Morin was on assignment for Ricochet Media. According to Ricochet, Morin was covering the dismantling of an encampment in the area of 95 Street and Roland Road when she was told by an EPS officer to leave the area. She identified herself as a journalist covering the dismantling of the encampment and was then arrested and told that she could be charged with obstruction of justice and held for up to 72 hours in jail. Morin sustained a minor injury to her wrist while being detained by the EPS. She was taken to a police station, charged with obstruction, and later released that day. Morin said that the residents of the encampment were primarily Indigenous, and that the police dismantling of the site was violent. Staying in national news, Federal Conservative MP Leslyn Lewis is promoting a conspiracy-laden petition to remove Canada from the United Nations. The petition makes conspiratorial claims that the UN programs are damaging children through the normalization of sexual values and activities, and claims these programs are being imposed on Canada in secret without the knowledge of Canadians or elected officials. Lewis is no stranger to promoting conspiracy theories on the national stage. In September of 2023, Lewis was quoted as saying that the World Health Organization could impose travel restrictions on Canadians within Canada, and that the pandemic was a step toward global government. Conservative Party leader Pierre Poilievre has also embraced many of the same conspiracy theories that Lewis promotes, including those about the World Economic Forum manipulating Canada's federal government. Our final story in national news is sadly the passing of former NDP leader Ed Broadbent. Broadbent served as leader of the NDP from 1975 to 1989 and served as MP from 1968 to 1990 and again from 2004 to 2006. Current NDP leader Jagmeet Singh paid tribute to Broadbent in a statement saying that he was the type of person that he himself wanted to be when he grew up and that he was, quote, a lifelong champion of our movement and our party, end quote. Broadbent was 87 years old. In labor news, members of the Fédération Autonome de l'Enseignement Teachers Union in Quebec has reached a tentative agreement with the province. It is the latest union that is a part of the Front Commun to reach a tentative deal. The Front Commun is an alliance of public sector unions in Quebec representing over 400,000 public sector workers. This united front has been engaged in rolling strikes since the fall in the largest labor action in the province in recent memory. The Front Commun announced on January 3rd that it and the Legault government had reached a tentative deal at the end of December and that members will have a chance to debate the deal in general assemblies that begin this month. A highlight of the deal is a historic 17.4% pay rise over 5 years and a clause that protects public sector workers' purchasing power. Bargaining negotiations continue for public healthcare workers represented by the Fédération Interprofessionnelle de la Santé du Québec, another Front Commun member. And finally, join us for Off the Hill this Wednesday, January 17th at 7:30 p.m. Eastern, 4:30 p.m. Pacific, as we explore the impact of the United States on Canadian politics. Guests include Timmins James Bay NDP MP Charlie Angus, senior researcher at the Canadian Centre for Policy Alternatives Stuart True, poet and activist L. Jones, and me, Rabble editor Nick Seabrook. As always, Off the Hill is hosted by Robin Brown and Libby Davies. Visit rabble.ca today to register. You won't want to miss it. To read the full version of all the stories we talked about today, please visit rabble.ca.
Thanks, Nick. And that's it for Rabble Radio this week. Thanks as always for tuning in. If you like the show, please consider subscribing to our show on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. And please rate, review, share Rabble Radio with your friends. It takes 2 seconds to support independent media like Rabble. If you have feedback for the show, ideas, stories, opinions you'd like us to cover, we'd love to hear about it. Get in touch with us anytime at editor@rabble.ca. Thank you to all the journalists and writers who contributed to this week's content on rabble.ca, and thank you to Carl Nirenberg for supplying the music. Lastly, thank you to you for tuning in to Rabble Radio. I'm Brianne Doyle, and I'll talk to you next week.